but 696541. This allows the escrow, or allows the real estate commissioner in its escrow audit process to collect some additional travel or traveling administrative expenses as a part of its audit fees. The commissioner does attempt to recover the cost of an audit through the audit fees charged to the escrow agent. Section 8 clarifies some enforcement language. There is nothing, essentially, nothing significant in there, as I understand it. It's simply some housekeeping measures. Section 9 amends 696555. This redoes the commissioner's receivership power. I mentioned before that we had two receiverships. Those two receiverships demonstrated very quickly that what we need is the power of the commissioner, like in the real estate act law, to become the receiver herself so that she, when she does the books as required by the law, she can simply order the payment out with the approval of the court instead of hiring someone to act as receiver and redo all of her work or simply the expense of taking it into court and having it okayed. Section 10, 696578, is a relatively new provision. It allows folks with large escrow deposits to agree to put them in something other than federally insured client's trust account. Allows them to buy investments, securities, U.S. governments. It allows them essentially, through the escrow agent, to invest those funds pending the closing or the completion of the escrow transaction. You'll note, however, that it also requires that the principal must give prior written approval to the practice. The principal must release the escrow agent from any liability so that there's no question that the bond and deposit are protected from claims for a loss because of a high-risk investment. And finally, that the escrow agent doesn't have any individual interest in the investment or earnings from the fund. So he's simply placing them for the convenience of the client. Section 11, 696581 is amended to allow two things, which other states have, which are new, if you will. The first one is to allow an escrow agent to accept excess funds and give a change check to the client currently without the instructions of both the buyer and seller, for instance. The best example here is where I, as a seller in another transaction, deposit my money into a new escrow as a buyer in another transaction. I don't know how much I'm going to need, so I deposit $20,000 if that's the proceeds from my last sale. And I only need $15,000. I don't have to wait for the buyer to agree to release the excess $5,000, which isn't needed in our transaction. I can simply authorize the escrow agent to give me what's called in the trade a change check. And in fact, they can do it on my single instructions as opposed to the instructions of both. The second one, which you'll find in lines 28 to 30 on page 9, is allowing an escrow agent to open a one-sided escrow.
Can I ask a question about that, Steve?
Yes.
I assume that it's up to the escrow agent themselves to make sure that they aren't giving the client too much excess money or that they've properly accounted for what's going to be needed in this escrow transaction, primary escrow transaction.
I'm sure that's correct. It assumes that there's been proper accounting done of the ins and outs so they know how much they need to close this second transaction. But it is a...
You're comfortable that that's a fair assumption that it's...
Madam Chair, our experience has been it is a...
It's an assumption that you can trust these escrow agents with.
You know, given $10 variances one way or the other, we're convinced that it works.
Okay.
It should work. Section 12 amends 585 to allow a higher minimum civil penalty for escrow agents. It will jump it from $500 to $1,000 for each violation. The fact here is that times change. Escrow agents generally are not suspended because of the pending transactions. Their license is not suspended. So we tend sometimes to wish that we had a higher penalty. The task force agreed that this was a reasonable starting point for a penalty, and that's what remains in the bill. Section 13 is a third area of dispute. This is in the bill at the request of the licensed escrow organizations, or their organizations, if you will, licensed escrow agents. It amends the trust deed foreclosure law, or the trust deed law, 86790 on page 10, and it removes the ability of escrow agents to, in effect, act as trustees in trustee foreclosure. Now, normally, most escrow companies aren't going to be concerned because they are also title companies. And therefore, they're going to come under the existing provisions on lines 14 and 15 of a title insurance company, and they can continue to do trustee foreclosures. They can argue for this however they'd like. It's their provision. But as we understand it, it simply removes the ability of two or three trust deed foreclosure-only operations. It would eliminate their ability to become licensed with us as escrow agents and compete with them in the state of Oregon. But that's the third issue, and I believe you have some testimony on it. Sections 14 is civil penalties for unlicensed activity. It allows a penalty that takes both a minimum amount plus any profit from the illegal operation. This follows what was done a couple of sessions ago for illegal real estate activity or non-licensed real estate activity. Section 15 removes the proration of license fees. The task force agreed that we get little enough in way of license fees. There was little need in a one-year license to prorate, and so they agreed to remove it. Finally, the provisions, you have an add provision in Section 16, and in Section 17, a delayed effective date of July 1, 1992, to apply whatever new bond deposit requirements there are to the next full year after the close of the regular legislative session. Those are the amendments that are proposed in A. Engrossed House Bill 2125. I'm asked to advise you by my boss that we consider the changes made on the House side in restoring the waiver and restoring the cap to be significant enough that we'll, of course, do whatever you'd like in terms of a policy and carry out the law accordingly. But if those changes remain in the bill, we'd ask that our name come off the bill as a requester of the legislation. We don't feel that it is a balanced bill with those two changes made.
Thank you. Is there a question?
Yes.
Thank you.
Going just on page one, the definition of escrow now includes a person selling his own property and holding the proceeds of sale until some triggering incident. And I gather that this is was conceived in sort of a corporate setting, where you have a company. Is there anything that would prevent an individual from doing this? And if that is possible, then what are the implications of that?
Senator Cohn, Senator Shoemaker, we've raised the question before the hearings on the House side. The same question. The term person is defined by R 174-100 to include both individuals and corporations, partnerships, and a couple of other things, associations, I think. So when you use the term person here, it's not redefined. You include both. Our question to legislative counsel at the time was, are you sure this simply limits it to corporate escrow agents who are dealing on their own or individual escrow agents who are dealing on their own? Or have we, in effect, put, you know, an exemption in here that allows anybody to act as their own escrow agent? Our answer was no. This is intended to cover only corporate escrow licensees. That's the answer we have. I think I understand what you're asking because it's the same thing we have.
Okay, but I think Senator Shoemaker, I want to follow up on his question. If you work for a corporation. If I work for a Tycor title and I wanted to go do my own, I wanted to go sell my beach property and trade it for something else and mix around my apartments and do whatever sort of my personal interest would be, what is it, what happens then? I come under this, I would be allowed to do that without...
Madam Chair, if I understand what you're asking, as an officer of Tycor Title, you can act for Tycor Title. That's the way the corporate licensee acts. They act through their officers. As an individual, Theoretically, you could escrow your own property, but the definition assumes that you're escrowing your own real or personal property transaction and holding your own documents, and I suppose you're not getting a fee for it. Because if you were, I think you'd be engaged in the professional escrow activity. If I understand your question, this gets muddy very quickly.
Just want to see if we can cut through it to know what the expectations are.
So
and I think we just heard that it gets muddy very quickly.
It's muddy very quickly. I wonder if we ought not be specific that this is limited to the escrow company rather than possibly any person within the escrow company.
Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, we had suggested that the, you know, the term escrow agent be placed in there or licensee or something of that nature. And as I understand it, we were told, no, it was unnecessary.
Yeah. Okay. We might want to take a look at that. I suggest you visit with Senator Shoemaker and Mr. Taylor to see about working, because I think we don't want to extend an invitation to people to do the wrong thing.
I think that's right. Another question on page 8. I noted here that the earnings of interest-bearing trust accounts may inure to the benefit of the escrow agent if especially approved in writing. And I'm kind of wondering, what is the reason for that? One would think that interest would go to the parties. Either they split it or it goes to one or the other, but not to the escrow agent. And then I'm troubled that, you know, the escrow agent could get that permission in the fine print, if you will.
Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, there are really two issues here. In the normal course of events, if you and I, for instance, open an escrow, and we realize there's a three-day float period for a bank's paper to clear in closing my transaction or your transaction, there's going to be some interest or there's going to be something earned on that money during that float period. In the simplest sense, we currently have escrow agents earning the benefit from that with the instructions, albeit at closing, signed at closing by their principals, allowing them to do that. And in return, for instance, a bank, because of the earnings on that total float, may offer them accounting services, may offer them marketing services, may offer them whatever it is the bank can offer them to get their business within the banking regulations office. This allows that to continue. It's currently permitted by rule. It allows it to continue. The second thing is that to the extent, and I guess this just says that all these folks are adults and they can decide how they like to do with the money, but this says that an escrow agent may want to share in the amount of interest earned as an additional fee or in lieu of raising a smaller fee to a higher fee. Mm-hmm. So it allows this practice, again, with written knowing consent between the parties, to occur as well.
I wonder if there's an invitation to abuse there. And certainly the situations you cite are appropriate enough, but one can think of a escrow account fairly long term between individual buyer and seller, not sophisticated in these things, and the escrow agent sort of leads them to believe that the ordinary practice is to have the interest accrue to the escrow agent. That's what we're supposed to keep our fees down to a reasonable level, and so they consent to that, and it really isn't fair.
Senator Cohen, Senator Shoemaker, the quick answer is that it's you and I who are going to feel the impact, if there is any, in our smaller transactions. The person who's dealing in a $1 million transaction theoretically worries about the interest on those funds pending the closing of the transaction. You and I may not recognize the fact that there would be interest earned to someone.
Mm-hmm.
To the extent that it's our transactions that are involved, I suppose we feel relatively comfortable simply saying, what difference does it make if we earn $3 interest or the fee is increased $3 to $5 for the escrow operation? We're never terribly comfortable with anything, but this one is a relatively good level of comfort. Again, we assume the person with the big bucks is going to earn the big interest They're not going to just ignore it and let somebody else take it without thinking.
Hey, any questions?
Yes.
Senator Hill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Steve, even with the schedule that you have for the surety bond depositor combination thereof, is this the only protection? I mean, when you're looking at even your schedule and you have here, for example, Tycor, $2.5 billion, what other factors are there to protect consumers? I mean, is there a reserve requirement for escrow agents at all, or what else is there?
Madam Chair, Senator Hill, there is not.
And so this is it?
This is it. Title insurance companies have a number of reserves and things through the
right.
Department of Insurance and Finance, but for escrow, this is it. That and their ability to pay their own debts before we receive knowledge of the problem. In other words, clean up their own mess. Traditionally, they have cleaned up their own mess, with some notable exceptions.
Which always come to your doorstep.
They come to our doorstep, one in the 750,000 in one and 250,000 in another, roughly. And those are pretty big missteps.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Other questions for Mr. Hawes? I would ask that you, if you haven't already, get your amendments drafted.
Okay.
With LC. I don't see them here, at least in that state. Thank you. Okay, Mr. Stanley, John Stanley.
Madam Chair, could I ask Steve a
yes, Senator Hill.
Before Mr. Stanley comes up. Steve, the chair brings up, what
Mr.
is...
Mr. Stanley, you can come on up and get settled. And
what is the extent of the problem? I mean, what? Give us some idea of what the problem is and why you're...
Madam Chair, Senator Hill, the best answer I can give to that is that with the two large receiverships that we had, we took a look at our whole card and there wasn't much there. We have had a very good relationship with escrow agents. Let me back up. Title escrow agents. Companies that are both title and escrow. The two large losses I talked about were from independent escrow agents.
Okay.
That is the difference. It's a significant difference. But in terms of the overall problems, we looked at the size of a $25,000 bond in 1991 and said, well, now, wait a minute. How many houses sell for $25,000? How many problems have we seen that if they were not covered could be covered by a $25,000 bond? For instance, the example I gave you of the wavered situation on the southern Oregon coast, we're talking about either the replacement of a septic system or the installation of a septic system if one can be put in. And we're talking probably $5,000 to $7,000 or some loss of value comparable to that in terms of the actual damages of the buyer of that particular property. That's a significant portion of a $25,000 bond.
Madam Chair, could I just continue? Is there then some reason that we should treat title companies that are escrow agents and just pure escrow agents differently?
Madam Chair, Senator Hill, we don't believe so. They have argued, and I think correctly,
they've
argued.
Do title companies have to have reserves?
They have to have, Senator Cohen, Senator Hill, they have to have reserves, mm-hmm. but the title reserves have nothing to do with escrow.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
Mr. Stanley.
John. Madam Chairman, my name is John Stanley. I was born in Oregon and been a resident of Oregon all my life. I've been working full-time in the title insurance and escrow business for 23 years, and I'm the president of Columbia Title in Hood River in the Dalles and also of Homestead Title in Pendleton and Hermiston. I'm also chairman of the agent section of the Oregon Land Title Association. The updating of the statutes, which would be achieved by this bill, are necessary for the industry in order to keep up with the current trends and practices and in order to clarify differences in opinion as to the effect of some of the current statutes. The agent section of the Oregon Land Title Association and my company support House Bill 2125 in the form passed unanimously by the House of Representatives. I'd like to point out specifically some of the things that Steve has addressed here. The division wishes to delete ORS 696-527 sub 4, which allows for the waiver of the bond. This provision was, in fact, drafted by Ralph Hillier, who at the time he was the Deputy Real Estate Commissioner for the state of Oregon. There were very good reasons for this, and they still do exist from time to time, and that is that the bonding market from time to time does dry up. That's one of the reasons. It's worked well. There's never been a company.
Can I interrupt you and say, and I guess I need to ask Steve to get back to us on this. We have the bankers who come in and say they want that you could put a surety bond or a unrevocable letter of credit. And I guess I want, before we're finished with this bill, eventually to see whether you think that would do if the surety bond business, quotes unquote, dried up.
I think that the cost, one of the things is that there is a cost here. Let me finish on with this, and then I kind of cover that. The escrow, if you read the statute, it does say, it doesn't just say that the commissioner shall. The statute does say that it will be waived for any escrow agent who demonstrates to the commissioner's satisfaction. Now, again, that was drafted by the real estate division or by a deputy real estate commissioner. And that was, I was around at the time that was being done, and that gives great discretionary power to the commissioner to review the information that's presented to them. In the case presented, the Southern Oregon Coast case having to do with a septic system, first of all, generally, what this protection is for is for funds, and escrow agents take funds on deposit and follow instructions for the delivery of documents. Now, if I had a cash deposit with the real estate division, or if I had a surety bond with the real estate division, I can almost guarantee you that within the two-year period stated, that cash deposit would have been returned or the surety bond would have been returned. So there really is no great difference between the two. As a matter of fact, there was one company that I owned that had a cash CD deposited with the state. That was given back within 30 days after the dissolution of the company. And so I believe it was about 30 days.
Madam Chair.
Senator Shoemaker.
I'm afraid you've lost. What's the significance of that comment?
Well, Steve brought up the fact that here's something that happened 2 years ago. Obviously, it doesn't. I doubt it had anything to do with money. It apparently had to do possibly with some claim that an escrow agent.
No, but you said something about either the cash bond or.
It would have been refunded to the agent. See, one of the provisions in the statute that's unchanged is that an agent can deposit a CD, for instance, or cash with the state treasurer in lieu of the bond. And that's what I'm saying, that would have been refunded, and the state would still not have had the protection after the company was closed.
Oh, so the bond and the cash deposit don't survive the closure of the company? Is that what you're saying?
I think it's within a certain amount of discretion of the agency, I would imagine.
As a matter of practice, hold it for the length of the statute of limitations on any claim?
I don't believe so. I know in my case they didn't.
I
can tell you, I did have another company that they did.
Well,
they
like
did
to,
have it for 1 year. They held
okay,
the deposit
we need
for
to
1 year.
I'd like to hear from them on that. I can't imagine they'd release it before the period of time that it could be claimed against runs out.
Yeah. One thing to keep in mind on all of these escrows, and I think it came up with these funds, and you're looking at these deposits of funds. I know in the case of my companies, the average time funds are on deposit is probably something less than 2 days. Typically what we're doing, there are cases where people hold money for long periods of time. My company does not hold funds for long periods of time because of the bond waiver. We turn down that kind of business. The only business we do is where we deposit funds for closing escrows, and we close the deals usually the following day, disperse the funds. Therefore, we've only got a a very short period of time. And one of the reasons is to keep the account balance down, so my company still qualifies for the bond waiver. There's only four companies in the state that currently are on this. There have been more in the past. And to demonstrate their the fact that they have kind of discretion, they just recently canceled one because of an it was in a very small county and there was an increase in business, which increased their average month-end trust account balances beyond their net worth. And there's been a lot of activity in the last few years, and that's probably temporarily knocked a lot of people out because of the increase in deposit balances. But these funds are not on deposit for long periods of time. And when there's problems, when people don't pay out, escrow problems come up very quickly. They're not things that generally they don't linger on and on and on. Generally, they come up, I would say, within a matter of days when people say, well, gee, you didn't give me the right amount of money.
I'm going to ask you to move on because we've got other people.
Okay.
We've got lots of bills up today.
Yeah, sorry. Please keep in mind that the net worth required to qualify for this affords much more protection than the bonding requirement does. And I kind of covered these informally. Okay.
Net worth to have the waiver, you mean? I'm sure.
Yeah. Yeah. The net worth required to have the waiver, of course, is in excess. It has to be in excess of your month-end average trust account balances. There have been two escrow agencies shut down. I do believe, and I unfortunately for a lot of the, I hate to say this, but in the current economics of the business, I think there's a basic underlying cause. It is extremely difficult for an independent escrow agency to be profitable. The competition in the overall industry for real estate settlement is such that the rates just don't support. In some cases it would, but in the vast majority of area, I would say, of Oregon, it just won't pencil out as a separate business. And I think this is part of the underlying cause for the two failures. As far as the maximum cap on the bonds, I was at several meetings with the real estate division, and I have to say that there was a comment that distressed me deeply that came up, and that was the words, we have to punish these companies with all these offices. Again, the measure of protection afforded at the $200,000 level I think is sufficient, and it certainly doesn't seem proper to punish somebody. And it doesn't affect me one way or the other personally, but it just seems that it's wrong to use that as a criteria for that. I don't believe there are any facts to support either the removing the bond waiver or the maximum cap. One of the other thing that that comes up here is interest on funds. The interest on funds issue is not. I wouldn't say in most of the cases that I'm familiar with, it's not direct. It hasn't been direct interest. What it is what the banks call long form analysis. It's basically, in its simplest form, it's the waiving of check fees, deposit fees, which all banks figure in their checking accounts. They'll figure, they'll say that it costs 1.5 cents to process a deposit and 2.2 cents to deposit a check. And what they're basically doing is allowing those types of fees and other kind of fees, accounting fees paid to outside service companies sometimes, and that has been referred to as interest in some of these cases too. And then there's other cases where companies do have agreements to offset part of their fee in exchange for the interest, and that's been actually being done. I believe I can remember about 10 years ago one company in the Valley was doing that with express instructions of all the parties. Another thing has to do with the removing escrow agents as trustees under trust deeds. Again, I've been in this business 23 years, and I think it was always customary whenever an escrow agent was trustee, which was very seldom, that in the event of a default, they would resign as trustee and an attorney would be appointed to conduct a foreclosure. I think only in the last few years has there been a trend for service companies, many of them from, or several of them from out of state, have come in used what I personally consider to be a loophole in the law to conduct foreclosure sales. And I think in some cases it has not been generally in the best interest of the public.
You're basically opposed to the Interstate Trustee Services activity under current statute?
Yes. Yes.
Madam Chair?
Senator Shoemaker.
Could I inquire what the problem is?
Well, there's been several problems. I think, first of all, I don't think there is adequate, if any, regulation of the business. There's two distinct parts of that business, and the primary, of course, under escrow law, an escrow agent again is following instructions and depositing of funds and things. Now, in the case of these trustee sales, they are conducting these foreclosure sales, which have very intricate legal ramifications. I mean, I have concern that anybody doing this as a business especially does need competent legal counsel, because it is a legally technical procedure. And under Oregon law, if they are, and there are cases of some companies that are doing
$1 million for the last biennium. The account itself is about $20 million. That interest regularly into the common school fund. If a property owner comes forward, finds out somehow about this property that's being held for them, they can then make a claim and obtain it. Current law allows that after 25 years, if no one has come forward to claim that monetary amount, then that property escheats and goes into the principal of the common school fund.
If they come in and allege that it's theirs, do they get back payment of all the interest?
No, they get only the principal amount of the account, and the interest is forever the property of the common school.
Okay, that's true as currently and as it would be under the proposed statute.
That's
okay.
Correct.
Thank you.
The A number of other states, primarily Washington, California, have declined to enter into reciprocity agreements with us because of the inconsistency between their laws and our laws. The Uniform Unclaimed Property Act that's used by many, many states nationwide provides for perpetual holding of property. Interestingly enough, Oregon's original unclaimed property law allowed for perpetual claims against the account. It was amended at a period of time when the record-keeping burdens were felt to be significant, and it was just too much trouble to keep track of this stuff for longer than 25 years, so the property started escheating to the state at that time. We've advanced enough since then that it's relatively easy to keep track of records, even in perpetuity, because of microfilming and computerizing and automation, and we used to do it all manually. Now we think that the benefits are much, much greater to tap into this whole nationwide system. And we believe that, Marcella, help me out, there's approximately $2 million being held by, $1 million being held by contiguous states and about $2 million more being held by remaining states, which is actually property belonging or suspected to belong to residents of Oregon. Those other states won't turn it over to us. They're not comfortable because they're afraid that if they turn it over, and some individual comes back to make a claim against them after we've escheated that property, that they would be liable. Under these reciprocity agreements, if everyone has the same laws and the same procedures, then all the states get the benefit of the efficiency of each holder in each state reporting to that state. The state abandoned property programs then take care of the paperwork of transferring property from state to state. And everyone comes out ahead in the end, where you have a much more efficient system of each state keeping track of the people in their state and trying to reunite property with those owners. And we think that the small amount that would be lost from the escheat procedure going away would be more than made up for the millions of dollars of property that we can't get our hands on in other states right now because of this discrepancy between
Thank
our
you.
Laws.
Thank you. Other questions?
One.
Senator Shoemaker.
If we were to decide to go for this, And then sometime in the future, we decided that this sheet made better sense after all, that it was important to put an end to things and not have a perpetual account that you never could close. Could we at that time reimpose an escheat requirement, or would we be somehow interrupting some kind of rights that existed in that account in perpetuity? In other words, could we go back the other way? Do you know?
I don't know. I don't know if that would be considered an impairment of contract or some vested right. It surprises me that we did that once already. I mean, yeah. It doesn't sound like it would be legal, so to speak,
right,
but it worked. I mean, there are people whose... The unclaimed property that was reported to the division prior to 1977, I think it was being held in perpetuity, and then in 77, when the law was changed, all that stuff escheated to the state automatically by virtue of that change in the law.
Pick up a little on both sides.
We did it once. That's what we do it again.
Yes. How many states have the reciprocity agreements?
Marcella, do you want to answer that one?
I'm Marcella Easley. I manage the trust property section, Senator Cohen's, Senator Hill. Most states, virtually every state, has reciprocity agreements with one state or another, and many states have them with virtually almost all the states. Oregon only has two right now, and they're even reluctant at this point to exchange property because of the liability. They just are concerned about owners coming forward. But it's the National Association of Unclaimed Property Administrators really encourages every state to have reciprocity. It makes it easier for the holders. It makes it more fair for the owners.
Thank you.
I should mention...
Any other questions? Are you prepared on this bill to move it?
Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2254, the floor can be passed recommendation.
Senator Hills moved House Bill 2254 to the floor with a depressed recommendation. There are no amendments. There is no one else signed up. Further discussion? Call the roll, please, Kate.
Senator Hamby.
Aye.
Senator Shoemaker.
Aye.
Senator Springer.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hill.
Aye.
Chair Cohen.
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's move to 20079. Larry Foster's here from the Health Division.
And Gary Oxman from the Multnomah County Health Division is here as well. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Dr. Larry Foster, the acting state health officer and the state epidemiologist for the Oregon Health Division. And with me I have Dr. Gary Oxman, who is the health officer for the Multnomah County Health Division. We're here to discuss House Bill 2079, which has to do with public health measures taken to control the spread of communicable diseases. For many decades, public health authorities have had the authority to quarantine or isolate persons with communicable diseases, basically without any provision for due process. And in 1987, the legislature passed a bill which did very carefully build in due process, judicial review of any restrictions that public health authorities might place on an individual to prevent the spread of communicable diseases. Now, when we talk about quarantine or isolation or public health measures, to use the terminology of the law, we're talking about diseases, only those diseases which may be casually transmitted. Specifically, I mean transmitted by the airborne route, where a person with a disease could be in this room, another person walk in, have no awareness that they are being exposed, and yet potentially be exposed. Tuberculosis is really the disease that we're talking about. There are two problems with the existing law. One of them is that it provides for a maximum of 60 days duration for the imposition of a public health measure. 60 days is not long enough to render a tuberculosis patient permanently non-infectious. It takes, with the average case, a minimum of 180 days to be sure that the person would not be infectious at some time in the future. And the second problem is that the law does not provide under any circumstances for such an individual to be housed in a jail. The bill you have before you tries to deal with these two problems, specifically in situations where there's substantial medical evidence that the disease is spread by the airborne route and that it cannot, that it either cannot be rendered non-infectious within 60 days or it could become infectious again after that period of time. It would extend the or permit the extension of the duration of the public health measure to 180 days maximum. And the second provision is that it would provide that failure to obey a court order or other public health measure should subject the individual to contempt proceedings. In other words, the patient who refuses to obey a judge's order to take anti-tuberculosis medications can be brought to contempt proceedings and potentially placed in jail to make it possible for the public health authorities to administer the medications needed to render that individual non-infectious.
Senator Hill.
It just seemed like jail is kind of the wrong place. I mean, sort of like here in the Capitol, the way things circulate around through here when people get sick. I mean, it seems like for airborne things, putting people in jail would be, I understand how you'd want to hold them, but to put them in jail, it would seem that, and I don't know how, maybe all the jails have places where you can quarantine people, but something like that seems, couldn't it just go through a jail pretty quickly?
Madam Chair and Senator Hill, thanks for bringing that point up, because we, of course, would never put such a patient in a jail unless there were provisions for preventing transmission, specifically having a special cell with ventilation to the outside that does not permit transmission of air from where the individual with tuberculosis would be housed into other parts of the jail. It would require an isolation cell, not in the sense of people isolation, but in terms of air isolation, ventilation isolation, just as we would have to have for the same patient in a hospital. So most jails would not be fit for that purpose. That's correct. It would only be...
Which ones would?
Well, Multnomah County specifically would.
Thank you. I want to continue.
That's all the testimony that I had. I would be happy to answer questions, but I would also mention that Gary Oxman, as local health officer for Multnomah County, has had direct experience in implementing this bill and some of the difficulties.
Right. Why don't you go ahead, Gary, your name for the record, please.
Yes, I'm Dr. Gary Oxman. I'm the health officer for Multnomah County. I recognize that this afternoon's session has run a bit more slowly, and I'll keep my comments to a minimum. I hope I can offer you a unique perspective, as I'm the only person in the state, to the best of my knowledge, who's actually instituted a quarantine or public health measure proceeding since the law was revised back in 1987. And I think the fact that it's been used only once is instructive in a couple of ways. First of all, it demonstrates the intent of public health authorities not to use quarantine except when absolutely necessary. Secondly, I think it also demonstrates the fact that our initial experience with the law, although successful, pointed out a number of problems, and it's made people in the public health community somewhat hesitant to use the law. I think the changes in House Bill 2079 really accomplish two goals. First of all, they create a potential to actually carry out a reasonable restriction on somebody who does not comply with a court order. Secondly, and perhaps more importantly, they create a credible threat. As the law is currently set up, there's really no substantial punishment or substantial restriction that we can place on anyone due to features of both the law and features of the medical environment. And as a result, we can go ahead and order somebody to comply with treatment, but if they choose not to do so, there's really very little in the way of consequence for them. And this bill, I hope, well, we believe will address those. What this bill will really accomplish is for us to use quarantine in a more aggressive fashion in terms of using it more often, but also to use it in a less restrictive fashion. And I think the experience of South Carolina is brought to mind, where they have, under their quarantine law, what they have is a procedure where a person with tuberculosis or another restrictable disease can be brought before a judge. The judge will simply order them to comply with treatment. That is to do what most of us would do out of self-interest and community interest. And then if they fail to do so, there are legal sanctions such as contempt of court or jail. What they found with that is roughly an 85% success rate, despite applying that law to a population of people who, by definition, were difficult to get to cooperate to begin with. So it creates a more flexible tool, and one that we could use under the current law, but there's really no consequence for noncompliance under the current law. In summary, I think what this bill will do is it'll make public health measures a more practical tool for public health officials. It will not affect the procedural and substantive due process features that are already there in the law. The person is extremely well protected, and it may actually increase the use of public health measures to a mild degree, but it will do so in a way that's less restrictive. Again, the average person under a public health measure, as I would use it, I would take the person to court, and the judge would order them to cooperate with the treatment that we prescribed, and that would really be the end of it in most cases. And finally, there would be a decrease in costs in public health measures and in control of tuberculosis specifically, both the financial costs in that retreatment of tuberculosis once somebody has resisted treatment and developed complicated disease is extremely expensive, both for the person and also for the other people who come in contact. More importantly, the social costs would be lower. We would have fewer tuberculosis cases because we would be better able to control spread of disease in the community, both for simple, uncomplicated disease, and also for the complicated, resistant disease that we're starting to see more and more in the community. I'd be happy to answer questions as well.
Thank you. Other questions, Senator Hill?
I'd like to ask, what do the rest of the counties do that don't have this kind of facility in their jails?
Madam Chair and Senator Hill, it is possible that one or two of the other jails might have such a facility, but for the most part, they would not. We would probably try to work out some kind of an inter-county arrangement. Fortunately, one of the things operating in our favor is that most of the tuberculosis in the state that occurs in this population that is very uncooperative does occur in Multnomah County. So for all practical purposes, it is a Multnomah County problem. It would be very rare to run into this situation elsewhere.
Well, Andrew, I guess my concern is that I understand that about tuberculosis, but I mean, this bill seems not specific to tuberculosis, and I just want to be sure that when the situation occurs that everyone understands what the situation is. If they try to find someone in contempt, what they must do with them, and I certainly wouldn't want them to end up in jail.
Madam Chair and Senator Hill, I completely agree with you, and I assure you that the public health authorities will not put a person in a situation where they would be have the possibility of transmitting their infection to other persons.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Hamby?
Yes, I wanted to ensure that, in fact, I was reading it correctly, because it does go beyond just the notion of tuberculosis, and secondly, to assure Senator Hill that I know we're picking up TB in some of our migrant camps frequently, and of course they're not being tossed in jail, but handled in a camp situation.
I think, could you give us an example of what other than tuberculosis you could find transmission?
But it says, or that it may recur after the public health measure is discontinued.
Madam Chair and Senator Hanby, the intention of the wording here is that, number one, the disease must be transmitted by the airborne route, and number two, either it cannot be rendered non-infectious within 60 days, or it may become the case may become infectious again after the 60 days. So it must be an airborne transmitted disease. And Madam Chair, we have scratched our heads very hard trying to think of other diseases that we might actually use this provision for. And in any practical sense, no, there are not other diseases. It's conceivable if someone should come in the country with Lassa fever, which is transmitted by the airborne route and which is a terribly deadly disease, and which we would, of course, put that person immediately, hopefully voluntarily, in respiratory isolation. If we had to, we would use the measure for something like that. if there were a chronic diphtheria carrier who refused treatment to eliminate the carrier state, we might use it for that kind of a situation. But we've not had such a case in my 14 years of working for the health division, and
this
I don't expect to see such a case.
We're not talking about things that are what we normally think of as lay people as transmittable diseases
no.
at all. When you use the terminology as airborne. Okay. What is it? Any other questions, committee members? Anyone else to sign up? No one has signed up on this measure. Does the committee feel comfortable in passing this bill out?
Yes.
Okay.
Also move.
Senator Hanby moves that we refer House Bill 2079 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Kate. Senator Hanby.
Aye.
Senator Springer.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hill.
Aye.
Chair Cohen.
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, we've got Representative Maddox here on a couple of bills, three bills, I think. So why don't you come on up, take them in whatever order.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'll try to make it quick. I know it's...
I've asked members to stay until about 3:15, since we get 15 minutes late, so if you could go quickly through three bills if you're interested.
We have three bills which passed the House unanimously. House Bill 2250...
That's not necessarily...
Doesn't mean a thing.
...of good use here.
Just
tell us the good bills. Then that's a good idea. It's
House
better.
Bill 2250 was unamended in the House. This is the bill which allows... Kevin Mannix, by the way, District 32, Salem, for the record. This allows use of certified mail with return receipt whenever the current statutes require the use of registered mail only. It changes some 70-odd sections of the statutes where many agencies of state government and local government have looked and they've seen that the language says, whoops, you've got to use registered mail. Well, registered mail costs $4.65 a unit. Certified mail with return receipt costs $2 a unit. So you're talking only $2.65 for a single transaction, not enough for any agency to bother coming before the legislature. But one water district pointed out that this provision costs them $2,000 a year. Then they extrapolated from that there are 140 water districts in the state, so it costs over $250,000 a year just for water districts to use registered mail instead of certified mail, and that's only one of the 70-odd sections of the statutes that are being changed by this bill. This does not change any form of notice to anybody. The whole point is, in the old days, you used registered mail when you wanted to make sure people got notice. And over the years, the Postal Service now offers certified mail, return receipt requested to make sure people get noticed. And registered mail is supposed to be used for items of value, such as stocks or bonds, which might be converted to cash by someone who's intercepting the mail. You don't need registered mail for most of these notices. You're, in effect, paying for insurance. And if we extrapolate from the water district testimony, it's at least $250,000 a year. And if you add the 70-odd other sections, there's a lot of money being spent. The reason why there hasn't been a real press to change the statutes is, if you look in the Code of Civil Procedure, there's a simple provision that says, well, when notice is the purpose of using registered mail, you might use certified mail. Well, it turns out that your clerks and your staff people and agency managers are not willing to take that risk and try to be lawyers and interpret whether or not the statute in their case means that they can use certified mail, so they don't use it. We lawyers may use it, but real folks don't. So it's a good bill, and I'd urge your passage of that measure.
Okay.
One. House Bill 2662 comes to you via our Judiciary Committee. This is another simple bill that arose out of testimony last session from women who have come to Oregon under the protection of restraining orders. Of course, it's not limited to women. They are usually the ones who are protected. It applies to any person who comes into the state of Oregon. Shelters near border areas tell us that a lot of these people do have restraining orders that they think still protect them within the state of Oregon. And there are some other folks here that might, there at least one other person to testify to this. In a nutshell, foreign restraining orders are not effective in the state of Oregon unless you have filed them with the court. And a lot of people come here, they think they're protected, they may even ask the police for protection, and they find out they don't have protection. This says that foreign restraining order is good for 30 days in Oregon. So that'll give people 30 days to file that restraining order with an Oregon court and get protection. And again, we had no opposition to it in the House. Do you want me to mention the third one, Senator?
Yes, please, and then we'll get back to Kate, who has comments on both of the bills.
And House Bill 2668 relates to the statutes of limitation. The Senate and the House visited this subject last session, which was, ironically enough, also House Bill 2668. We extended the statute of limitations for somebody who was sexually assaulted as a child, sexually abused as a child, to bring a cause of action once that person became an adult. We extended it by 5 years after the age of 18. That was fine, and it was a good measure. However, we also had evidence and information presented to us, some of it subsequent to passage of this measure, some of it as the measure was going through, that there are people who in their 30s or 40s will be in a dysfunctional marriage or a dysfunctional sexual relationship or are acting dysfunctionally as adults in some fashion, who go in for a psychiatric treatment or psychological counseling or therapy, and the curtain drops, and they realize that they were subjected to sexual abuse as a child. They blacked it out, and they did not reawaken to this until they were adults. That person, the perpetrator, may still be around, may have the financial means through legal process to be forced to pay for whatever counseling the victim needs, but statute of limitations has passed. This would allow the injured person who has this rediscovery, date of rediscovery, to use that and trigger it and allow 3 years from that date of discovery. It's been proposed as a potential amendment to this bill. The limitation to 6 years after the age of 18 might be still too tight for a general cause of action, and I've suggested to the chair in a letter to her or memo that maybe we want to take it up the age of 30, which would be 12 years, or perhaps you want to use the general concept of statute of repose, which is 10 years, and that would incorporate some people who have been damaged in the past, intentionally abused, and they want to bring legal action. Thank you.
Okay. Kate Brown, and I guess, Kate, I would ask you to speak to 2662, the restraining order issue first, because I don't think there's any complications at all with that one, and I'd like to try to move it today.
Madam Chair, my name is Kate Brown, and I'm here on behalf of the Women's Rights Coalition. We would urge you to support and pass House Bill 2662. You have in front of me the testimony of Vianna Helmley, and she is the director of the Mid-Valley Women's Crisis Service here in Salem and was unable to be here today. Basically, what this bill does is cover a where there's no protection in the law. It enables a woman or a man to receive protection from our law enforcement system. If, in fact, the restraining order, she's not able to register a restraining order with the law enforcement data system. Given that many people come to Oregon for safety and protection, we feel that this is very important legislation.
Go ahead. Yeah, I think 2662, we can probably, Senator Hill.
Yes, Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2662, the fourth of due pass recommendation.
Further discussion? Call the roll, please, Kate.
Senator Hamby.
Aye.
Senator Springer.
Aye.
Yeah.
Vice Chair Hill.
Aye.
Chair Cowan.
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you very much. Okay, let's take up 2250.
Yeah. Madam Chair, I will move House Bill 2250 to the floor to pass recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Keel has moved 2250 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussions? Call the roll, please, Kate.
Senator Hamby.
Aye.
Senator Springer.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hill.
Aye.
Chair Cowan.
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you very much. Okay, then we... There is no one else who signed up on 2668. We'll come and revisit that one with further deliberation. I want to take up one more bill, 2377.
Thank you.
And we have Maurice Russell here.
Chair Cohen, Vice Chairman Hill, members of the committee, I'm Maurice Russell. I represent the debtor-creditor section of the Oregon State Bar. I have no prepared statement today because this is a fairly straightforward bill. It's been requested to remove a problem which has bedeviled lenders and borrowers alike for quite some time. As the bill is presently, as the law is presently interpreted primarily by the bankruptcy courts, it is virtually impossible to put rents as collateral for a loan, because the bankruptcy courts have concluded that such a security interest is not perfected until a receivership has taken possession of the property, or the lender themselves have taken possession of the property. That means that subsequent lenders who are able to beat one to the possession of the property or a receivership, or the bankruptcy trustee in the event an intervening bankruptcy is filed, will be able to take the rents and profits and cut the lender out of the process. This means that borrowers have that option for credit option removed from their portfolio. It means that lenders have an incentive to race to the courthouse to get receivers before the borrower applies for bankruptcy, rather than try to work out an agreement with them. And it reduces the amount of credit available to borrowers and creates general problems for lenders who misunderstand the statute as it's presently written. We request that assignments, where rents are assigned, they be possible to be assigned presently instead of at some future time, and that that assignment be perfected upon recording of the assignment of rents in the courthouse, rather than waiting for a receiver to be appointed. This was passed by the House, and that's the version in the A. Grossford bill.
Okay, are there questions of Mr. Russell? Anybody interested in moving this bill? Or we can wait. I'm not, whatever you think. You want to hold it over for the full committee? Well, let's wait a few minutes. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Russell. Okay, we're all set. We have 775. I might be interested in holding that one over let's have Ingrid come on up and see what stage we are, just for information, and then we'll probably deal with it on Friday.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, at this point, the bill has come to us from the Transportation Committee, and there are witnesses who were asked by that committee to present amendments to the Judiciary Committee, and I have some amendments. I understand that there would be additional amendments.